from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, San Francisco Poet Laureate Alejandro Murguia joins us in studio. His latest volume of poetry is called Stray Poems, and it's dedicated to the community of the Mission in the city by the bay, which he calls the City of Poets. We'll talk with him. We'll hear some of his verse. That's all coming up ahead after this. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Welcome to another hour of the program. In his inaugural address as San Francisco's sixth poet laureate, Alejandro Murguia said, "Never forget that San Francisco is a city of poets. Therefore, each and every one of you is a poet until proven otherwise." We're going to talk with him in this hour and talk about a number of things, including the role of the poet laureate, and discuss some of his own bilingual poetry and hear from him as he honors us by reading some of that poetry. I also should say that his newest collection is called Stray Poems. He's a founding member and the first director of the Mission Cultural Center for Latino Arts and teaches Latino studies in that department at San Francisco State. And welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a pleasure to be here on the radio. You know, I've always wanted to have my own radio show, so I really appreciate you giving me the chance to be here with you.
Well, we can switch sides. And okay. I'm delighted to have you here. Actually, when you talk about San Francisco as a city of poets, I think hasta ahora. Those are the words that come into my mind, because the city's changing. The whole face of it, you've become so identified with the Mission District, but even that district is changing now. A lot of techies, a lot of millennials, and more upscale.
Well, yes, but I think poetry has a very important role to play in our society and to play in our city in terms of giving voice to those who have perhaps been marginalized, to giving voice to those who perhaps feel powerless. And I think poetry has that role to play, as well as, I think, another important issue going on in our city, in our society, the question of literacy. And very concerned about that as a writer and a reader myself. So I think there's a lot of issues and roles, and I think people in our society are looking for an alternative, and I think poetry is a good alternative.
You can get people excited about wanting to read. I was in a couple of literacy projects by actually having them hear poetry, can't you?
No, absolutely. I think sometimes what we forget is that poetry is an oral art, and it should be presented orally, out loud. And I'm very big on not just reading poetry, but how the poet reads it. Their phrasing, their interpretation of the words. So a lot goes into the question of poetry, not just writing it on a piece of paper.
Many of the people that you're talking about, though, the people that you particularly want to have an impact on, are being forced to move out of San Francisco, though. I mean, the rents are too high if they don't have rent control, or the price of housing has gone up to such a degree that it makes it impossible for them to live here.
And I think, obviously, that's a big issue, top to bottom. Everybody's talking about it. And although it's changing the fabric of San Francisco and the texture of it, again, I think it's the artists and the writers and the poets and the dancers and the playwrights that will keep San Francisco from becoming totally gentrified or totally monolingual in that sense. And so I think more effort needs to be put into preserving the artists of our community. And let me just give you one very brief example. One of the artists that's being evicted right now as we speak is Renee Yanez. And Renee is an international cultural figure, not just of San Francisco or the Mission District. And so it raises the question, well, what is the city doing to preserve the artistic integrity of the city? Much like, let me just keep going a little bit, the destruction of the murals in the Mission District. Why is it that nobody in the city government ever stood up for those murals? And let me just gently point out that to destroy or deface public art is against the law.
Alejandro Murguia is with us in studio. He's San Francisco Poet Laureate, and I guess when he was named Poet Laureate, he made it clear to Mayor Lee that he would like a parking permit, and you're actually writing poems on the back of parking tickets. Yeah.
All the time. Try haiku for a parking ticket.
Well, actually, speaking about haikus, there's one on page 100 in your collection, in the new collection, Stray Poems. I just remember that page number. Can you give it to us?
Yes, actually, I had the opportunity recently to travel to various parts of the world, Japan in this case, last year, Europe. And obviously, you cannot be in Japan without being totally affected by its culture and its sense of aesthetic. And of course, its haikus. So here's a haiku for you. Before the vast open universe, human scale. Only in a poem.
And delivered with the kind of breadth that we associate with haikus. Very well done. Thank you for that. You are, I must say, from reading your poetry, a passionate man and a man who cares a great deal about the poor and the invisible and those who don't have the recognition because of lack of economics or lack of language or all of those kinds of things. And I was struck also by a kind of... And I'm struck in this in a lot of poets who come from similar background to yours, and you write about many of them in Stray Poems, being so political, and being so political on the left. There's a poem of yours called Fuego Ahora, and I'm thinking, what are we burning? Why are we burning? And it seems like you're burning with a sense of obligation to those who need help.
Well, you know, I come from a Latin American background, and in Latin America, there is no division between one's art and one's politic. They are the same. But I think in the United States, too often artists and perhaps writers and poets have made a very conscious decision that they will separate those two issues. And I often hear artists or poets say, no, I'm totally apolitical. There is no politics in my poem.
If you're apolitical, you're political.
Absolutely. That's what I point out to them. No, those are your politics. You have very clearly defined politics. You just don't understand it. And so it's a different world. And I often raise that question philosophically with all the important issues confronting the United States and all the, let's say, poor decisions made by our political leaders regarding things like torture, invading other nations, assassinating political leaders, attempting to assassinate political leaders. Where's the dialogue amongst our writers concerning those issues? Where are the stories about Guantanamo, for example, that confront these very basic human issues? So I don't necessarily think that it's about writing for the poor or about that, but about confronting the basic human issues that confront all of us as human beings.
You know the writer Barbara Kingsolver? I mean, she actually established a fund for those who would write novels, for example, that are more political or at least politically social conscious in that way. Because you're right, there's a lot of separation, a lot of emphasis, at least in American literature, more on the aesthetics often as opposed to, I mean, there's been a battle between writers in America for years, what should be political in work as opposed to what should be separate from it. But you also write about many of these poets that you admire, and a lot of them, like Roberto Vargas, who was a strong supporter of the Sandinista, or Pancho Aguila, who was a political bank robber, basically. I mean, these are people on what we could describe as the far left, yes?
Well, it depends, I guess, where you're standing. The political spectrum kind of changes. One might consider someone a leftist, but from another perspective, they could be just merely a liberal or even a quasi-conservative or middle-of-the-roader. So I'm not really big on those sort of definitions. I prefer a more sort of inclusive vision of our society.
You can't separate revolutionaries from in terms of their ideology or what when they want to rob banks, for example, for the cause?
Well, it depends also on the political moment. What might have been appropriate in the 1970s is perhaps not as appropriate, you know, second decade into the 21st century. And I think part of being a poet and an intellectual is being able to have your ideology or your thoughts or your stance grow and change as the world changes. For example, even more recently, a few years ago, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, considered a totally radical, way out, far left sort of guy, pointed out that armed struggle in Latin America is passé. So there you go. There you have this sort of super radical saying, no, armed struggle is passé. So would you still paint him as a super radical in that sense? So it changes and evolves, just like the right wing changes and evolves and comes up with new social issues to confront the electorate with. So do I think progressives change and adapt their worldview as conditions change as well?
Since you mentioned Hugo Chavez, you have a whole piece in this collection, Stray Poems, called Caracas, Not Paris.
Caracas is not Paris, yes. I tend to end my poetry collections with a sort of prose poem. It's kind of been traditional in all my poetry collections. And that's actually one of my favorite pieces because it blends together not just the question of exile or the role of Paris in the exiled community of Latin America, but also very important poetic figures for me, like Cesar Vallejo, who lived in exile in Paris and died in Paris. So it raises, for me anyway, all these issues of what Paris represents, and perhaps Paris is just the European version of Caracas.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, with San Francisco poet laureate Alejandro Murguia, who most recently published a collection called Stray Poems. He's also a founding member and the first director of the Mission Cultural Center for Latino Arts, and it's also glad to see in Stray Poems that you mention a poet who is a favorite of mine going way back, and that's Bob Kaufman. And he's too often sort of rendered unto oblivion, but he was a major figure in San Francisco, particularly in the Bohemian movement and particularly among those who love poetry.
He was a huge influence in my own work. When I was a young brown buffalo, for example, Golden Sardine, the first book that he published, to me was just like, awesome combination of jazz and poetry and incredible images. And even his other books, Solitude Crowded with Loneliness, huge influences on me. And I was very fortunate to have met him several times, to have had a chance to kind of be in his presence, especially during that period when he had taken the vow of silence in protest to the Vietnam War. And I know many politicians I wish would take a vow of silence.
Well, you also had the unusual suggestion of having poetry workshops for the Board of Supervisors.
This, you know, it seems like I'm being facetious, but more and more, I'm more and more serious about this. Let me just point out that the studies that I have read show that about 18-19% of the adult population of San Francisco is illiterate. That means they can write their name, but they can't read the newspaper. They can sign their name to a contract, but they can't read the contract. They can't read my books, for example. And then if we expand that to our wider society, I think the biggest issue right now, especially after our election, can we please have a literacy test for everyone running for office, and especially for those who have been elected to office, because otherwise, how do we know that they can actually read? We have this big brouhaha going on across the country about the student core testing. Well, I would like to see a testing for the politicians. Have them read out loud, for example.
How about not only reading, but being technically literate, being financially literate?
Well,
we have politicians who are illiterate on every front.
On every front. Can they read a budget? Can they understand a budget? Can they read, you know, documents? And this would be important also for the lobbyists to support this measure, because it's also incumbent on the lobbyists that their politicians be able to read their orders properly so that they interpret what the lobbyists want perfectly in that sense. So I'm all for a literacy test for anyone running for public office.
And I'm all for maybe having our listeners hear you read some of your poetry. I was going to lean on you to read a Lorca poem because I was a big admirer of Garcia Lorca, and maybe even would say love Garcia Lorca, not too strong a word to use. And this is a poem that we were thinking of making into a paper airplane, I know, right?
Well, I think during my inaugural, I actually formed it into a paper airplane and launched it into the audience. And I was very lucky that time because the paper airplane actually flew about 40 or 50 feet. So that was nice.
And before you commence reading this, by the way, just say something, if you would, about the difference between, say, reading a poem in English and reading a poem in Spanish.
That's a good question, you know, something I think about often. I think Spanish is just a softer language, and English tends to be a little bit harder language. And so though they may be the same poem, I think they're just different in each language. Each language is unique to itself in that sense. And I've been very lucky with the Lorca poem because it has been translated into French. It's coming out soon in a book of poems translated into Italian. So it's one of those poems that has actually circulated around the world. And let me just say about Lorca, besides being a great influence on my own life and being one of the great poets of the 20th century, it's also a reminder, I think, of the power of poetry and how governments feel poets are so dangerous, right? He was assassinated, executed actually, his body thrown into an unmarked grave that to this day nobody knows exactly where Lorca is buried. Lorca's dream. They tell me that your clavicle is a star over Andalusia, that your melancholic metacarpals still clutch a clod of earth in Sevilla, that your hips have not ceased dancing in La Habana como en Nueva York, that jasmines bloom in your eye sockets and every petal a poem, that your jawbone is the voice of all the silenced ones, the undocumented ones, those insulted and executed, that the moon cradles your bones, Federico, fragile as hummingbird wings. That's what I was told one silvery night by the hip red ants that sleep in your cranium.
Yeah, that's a wonderful poem. Bravo.
Thank you, Michael.
And a poem which also, to me, speaks about the impact of poetry. That's really what, I mean, it's a sort of testament to Lorca, but it's also about the effect that poetry can have.
No, absolutely. And one of the reasons he was executed is because his poetry had so much effect on the consciousness of the Spanish people and his work in general, especially his plays, which are pure genius, right? La Casa de Bernarda Alba, Blood Wedding, Yerma, super powerful works that was changing the consciousness of Spanish society.
Talk, if you would, about the accessibility of poetry. As someone who teaches it, I run across this a great deal. And, you know, I, for example, for years taught The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, and students were mystified by it, and yet at the same time Eliot said, you have to read it just in a sense of what it communicates to you on a deeper level, what it brings about in terms of your emotional response to it, which, of course, is the very language of metaphor in poetry.
Several things about that. One, you know, poetry in other parts of the world is like part of the fabric of society. Nicaragua, for example. You cannot go to a party in Nicaragua without somebody spontaneously jumping up and reciting from memory Rubén Darío. Yeah? You go to Europe, and you see this all the time. People can recite poetry from memory, not necessarily their own, but their favorite poet. But you come to the United States, and about half of 1% of those that read books read poetry. So there's a big gap, I think, in the United States in regards to how we appreciate poetry, how we write it, how we read it. And I think, again, one of the important things of our society, and Edward Said says this, right, the great Palestinian philosopher and critic, that the best way to understand any society is to understand its literature. So if a society is absent of poets, I think there's a big gap in what that culture or what that particular community and how it is reflected.
Talking with Alejandro Murguía, and he is San Francisco's poet laureate, and his new collection is called Stray Poems. You know, there's some poems in here which I hesitate to use a word, but speak to a certain kind of machismo. I'm thinking about on page in the collection 53 and 54, those two poems, but also when you write about breaking up with a woman and throwing her earring out the window because you want to... would you mind reading that one, in fact? Because it's going to have some effect on the listeners, I think.
Okay.
Then we can talk about machismo.
Well, first of all, in the translation of the word macho or machismo, I think something is kind of lost in the translation, because in Spanish, in Latino culture, to be a macho also has positive connotations, right? It means that you take care of business, that you take care of your family, right? That you behave in a respectful way. In fact, we have a saying, lo cortés no quita lo valiente, meaning to be courteous does not make you any less brave. So it's a combination of that.
It's strength, as opposed, it's used sometimes, he won't pick up the socks, the wife says, therefore he's machismo. Or
he's just some guy who doesn't understand that he needs to pick up his own socks, right? It's got nothing to do with being a macho or anything like that, right? And so I think sometimes that gets misinterpreted.
But give us that poem about the earring.
I'll give you the earring, okay? It's actually based on an old danzón title, and like the danzón has the same name. El arete. During our last fight, I threw one of your Mexican silver earrings out the window where the street swallowed it, breaking forever the pair you loved so much. And I did it so you'd never wear them for another man.
Okay.
What's machista about that?
Well, no, what's machista about that? Maybe give us another one, like in 53 or 54, which is perhaps more in the context of what we're talking about here.
Michael, you know these poems pretty well.
Well, it's my job.
You want Big Girls Don't Cry or Hombre
Big Girls Don't Cry is a good one, yeah, okay. Because the movie of the Four Seasons is coming out, Jersey Boys.
Okay. Big girls don't cry. I warned you it'd be hard loving a man like me, someone dangerous with rough hands that want to squeeze your tender waist, a man who absent 5 months shows up without calling, just appears on your porch, ringing your doorbell, and wants all of you now, this instant, as if he owned you on the hallway carpet or the kitchen table, who smokes cohibas when he's talking and spits them out when he's done. A man who doesn't know how to lose, won't take no, and yes, is calamitous. A rogue, an outlaw, a pirate, who still sleeps with his ex-wife, but calls you his booty babe muñeca, then leaves at dawn a fugitive without a word goodbye because you said you were a big girl, knew what you were getting into. I told you it'd be tough. Now come here and kiss me.
Oh, okay. Que hombre, huh? You can join us with our guest, Alejandro Murguía. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. You want to talk about poetry? You want to talk about Latino culture? You want to talk about illiteracy? You want to talk about machismo? Whatever's on your mind, join
us. District.
866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Alejandro Murguía, and he is San Francisco's poet laureate. And here's a Facebook comment from a listener named Griselda, and you can put your comments onto our Facebook page, who said, just wanted to comment that I took a class from Professor Murguía, and he encouraged us to write and chronicle, and it was one of the most memorable assignments in my student life, visiting the San Francisco Mission Cultural Center and walking the Dia de los Muertos procession.
Nice.
You make an impact. It's nice to know when you're a teacher that you make that kind of impact, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But talk about your connection to the mission, because it's obviously of such great importance to you.
Well, I think it's been part of my fabric for almost my entire adult life. And perhaps influenced a little bit by writers like Hemingway, who was so fixed on place, whether it was Paris or Havana. The Mission District has become my Paris, my Havana. That's what I write about. And I go all over the world reading stories and poems.
Are you going to continue, as Laureate, what Jack Hirschman did with all that international poetry here in San Francisco?
Well, it's a good question, Michael. You know, unfortunately, the International Poetry Festival won't be happening anytime soon. There just isn't the money to support it.
And it's a shame.
Total shame. And one of my final projects that I would like to do, there's two big projects I would like to do before I end my tenure. One, Floricanto, that's a poetry festival on 24th Street to celebrate poetry in the Mission District and Latino poetry. And hopefully we can do that May of next year. And the other project that I would like very much to do is to put a plaque honoring Oscar Zeta Acosta outside of the Hotel Royan, the Mission's finest. Now, why would I want to do that? Well, because Oscar wrote one of the great novels of United States literature, The Revolt of the Cockroach People, and he wrote it in the Hotel Royan. And I think that achievement deserves a plaque honoring his work.
Is the book still in print?
Oh, yeah. No, the book is still in print. Oscar only wrote two books, The Autobiography of a Brown Buffalo and The Revolt of the Cockroach People. And he's actually the one who teaches Hunter Thompson how to write Gonzo. And he also teaches Thompson about Dos Equis and Guacamole, perhaps more important contributions to United States letters. But what unfortunately happens with Oscar around 1974, he vanishes in Mexico, never to be seen again or any heard from again. So I think it's important to acknowledge his memory and his contribution to literature in San Francisco and the Mission District.
Yeah, I remember the story about him and his disappearance. I think Oscar Villalón, in fact, told me that story, but I've never read him. So thank you for bringing him back into my consciousness. Now you've got your work translated into other languages. We have a filmmaker here filming your life. Talk about all these things that are happening. I mean, this, being a poet laureate is no small deal. It goes all the way back to Lawrence Ferlinghetti, in fact.
Yes, Lawrence was actually the very first poet laureate, and I've been very blessed to have a very good relationship with Lawrence, City Lights, Nancy Peters, Elaine Katzenberger. All of them have been very big supporters of my work going way, way back, but also very big supporters of Latino writers, both in this country and in Latin America. Publishers, for example, also Juan Felipe Herrera, California State Poet Laureate, Guillermo Gomez Peña, and just a whole slew of other Latino writers. So I've been very blessed by that. And then also very fortunate that not only the documentary film based on my work, but a film based on my short story, The Other Barrio, has just been completed and will be ready for distribution to film festivals in the coming weeks. So very excited about that project.
And we should mention, by the way, of the six, and you are the six poet laureates, of the six poet laureates, three have been women, Devorah Major and Janet Mercatani and Diane DePrima. And you write in your book about really so many of the important figures in that have contributed to the Latino literary scene. But it's not really until things kind of change in 1979. We have a lot of Salvadoran writers, as you point out. But what we really also see is women not coming into the prominence, Latina women in poetry until the 90s with figures like Daisy Zamora and Nina Serrano. I mean, for a while, get back to this macho question, I guess, you know, poetry was the province of men.
Well, yes and no. From the very beginning of our involvement in the Mission District and our collaboration as a publisher, for example, with Tintan Magazine, we always published women writers. In fact, in the very first issue of Tintan Magazine, Nina Serrano writes an essay about a women's conference in Cuba. So from the very beginning, we've always tried to have a very wide and inclusive vision. I have never considered myself, for example, a nationalist or a chauvinist. No, quite the contrary. I consider myself an internationalist and tried always to be inclusive in my work as a publisher or organizing readings.
But when you say all these lovely things about, you know, your poet laureateship, so to speak, is everybody's, and everybody is a poet, and so forth and so on. Yet, you know, this is an honor that is yours for your work.
Well,
it's not something you necessarily see in a collectivist sense, except from your heart.
Yes and no. I told the mayor this when he called me up and asked me if I would be poet laureate. And I told him I will accept, but in the name of my community, because I know better than anyone, this is not a personal honor for me, but it is an honor that belongs to the community of the Mission District, of Latino writers, and poets in general throughout the city. And as I mentioned in my inaugural address, I mentioned about half a dozen poets who would have been poet laureate before me had circumstances not gotten in the way. People like Roberto Vargas, for example, Al Robles, Serafin Sequia, and many other poets that I grew up with and had great influence on me, and for whatever reason, fate, circumstances.
Timing.
Life, timing. It just fell on me in that sense.
You wear it well, and I like your sweater, too. Can you say
Thanks.
A word about that? It's a very Mexicano sweater.
Right? Actually, this is...
Cubano. What is
No, it's actually Mission District by one of the great artists here, Michael Roman, who does the silkscreen patterns, and he actually did the design of one of my early books of poems, Spare Poems. And so I'm always very pleased to promote artists of the Mission District out of San Francisco, and not just Latino artists. You know, about a month ago at Alley Cat Books, I did a reading for Anthony Holdsworth, a great, great artist who had an incredible exhibit of Mission District paintings. So it's not just Latinos, you know, it's not just the Mission District. I want to represent, and I feel that I represent the entire community of San Francisco. And I feel right at home, by the way, in North Beach, because it used to be a Latino barrio. So whenever I go to North Beach, I feel like I'm just going home.
And whose face is that on your sweater? His sweater is very colorful, by the way. Is that Pancho Villa?
No, it's Zapatistas.
Oh, okay.
And young warriors from the Mexican Revolution. And it's really actually a very colorful jacket that I'm wearing. And again, made by Michael Roman, very well-known artist here in the Mission District.
Me disculpa. I've been saying sweater, but it is a jacket.
Yeah, it's a jacket.
Let me get a caller on here. And Evangeline, good morning. You're on the air with us.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So, Michael, you mentioned what's happening in San Francisco with the change, you know, people being evicted, the rise of tech culture. And I'm wondering if you could talk, Mr. Mejia, about how you see the role of poetry changing as we're in this digital age. How can we, you know, as people are talking about books being a thing of the past and it's all about Kindle and e-readers, how can we cultivate the art of poetry as a written, as an oral form? And I ask this as a teacher and a musician, just trying to keep it alive.
Well, although there's a lot of pressure on the artist and the poetic and the written community in San Francisco, I always point out that San Francisco probably has more poetry readings than any city that I'm aware of. I mean, any day of the week, practically, there's a poetry reading somewhere, including one that I sponsor for emerging poets called Voz Sin Tinta, which is curated by two great young people, Marguerite Munoz and Jose Cadena. Second Thursday of every month at Alley Cat Books draws 40 or 50 people. And these are emerging writers. Writers who haven't published big books yet or have a big record, etc. And so I think there, as I keep saying, our society, our city is desperate for alternatives to what's going on. And so I think poetry and literature and art and murals and dance have a big role to offer as an alternative
does
to the
include,
violence, for example.
Does that include slam poetry?
I think slam, again, is a form of 21st century poetry. I can be critical of it, but then I can also be critical of English department poets, yes? The good thing, though, I think, about the slam poets is that they're going back to memorizing the poetry, right? Which, if you know anything about Homer and those cats, that's how poetry begins, where the poet would memorize 10,000 lines, for example.
I love it when you refer to Homer and those cats. I think about Homer as a cat.
A cool cat,
a very cool cat. Yeah, let me get another caller on here. Stefan, good morning.
Yeah, hi, good morning. You know, I have poetry in my heart. I have artists in my family all my life. and yet I have the most difficult time finding, the will or the courage to start writing, you know, and in a sense, because I feel like, you know, there's such a long history in poetry to be respected in its form and structure, and it's, you know, even though there seems to be a broad spectrum of that structure, it yet seems to be something to be respected and hard for me to open up the door with and to dive into. And I'm wondering what advice you can give me to, I know I might hear from you, well, just start writing, but that's not working for me. I don't know how to do that. And in a sense, it's very difficult, and yet I have a lot of energy and a lot of passion to put down on the paper in my observations of the world. And I don't know exactly how to integrate that into the structure of the poetry as it's commonly known, especially in the school system.
You have some wisdom for him, Alejandro?
Well, let me say this. My own poetry is an impure poetry. It's not meant for academia. So I would say to anyone who wants to write poetry, not to worry about any particular form or trying to be as good as someone else. No, I think the best thing is to just be honest about what you feel, right? And just write it down in the most direct and simple and honest language that you have. Don't worry about the big words.
But forgive me, what about reciting it first or trying to do it orally? Because he said he couldn't write it down. He's tried that.
But for me, the recitation of it, which I do a lot, by the way, I don't always read poetry. I recite it from memory. But that only comes after reading it 100 times, right? At home or in the process of revising it, yes? And although it seems a cliche that, just write it, it's like the old saying that goes, the novel of 1,000 pages begins with the first sentence. And it's the same thing with a poem. Write down the first words, yes, and just keep it simple and honest, and I think you'll be okay. But the other thing, though, equally important, but I think you're already doing that, is you must read and read widely. If you want to write poetry, read nothing but poetry. You want to write short stories? Read nothing but short stories until you understand the whole range of those who have written short stories and find your own sort of place and your own subjects that you want to write about.
Sage advice, Stefan. Good luck to you, and thank you for the call. And you don't have to be well, let me come to one of your poems again. There's a poem about tequila. And it suggests that if you drink enough tequila, you'll be Mexican sort of by transfusion or something along those lines. Could you read that poem?
It's called A Tequila Song. If you read enough Mexican poetry, like Octavio Paz, you will become Mexican. Let me read that poem again. If you drink enough tequila, you will become an honorary Mexican and may be stopped for identification.
Yeah. Let me get another caller on here, and that's you, Paula. Good morning. Paula, are you there? Well, no, I'm sorry. I'm hearing a bad connection there. Let's go to Elliot in Alameda. Elliot, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Hey, I just had a question for your guest. I have a Spanish background and Spanish family members, and I was wondering what you think about the interplay between the Spaniards and the indigenous people in Latin America, how that affected the culture and how that affects the art today.
We talk about open-ended questions. Huh?
Yes, that's a question that takes maybe 500 years to answer, but looking at the positive things of that encounter and of the blending, I think the beauty now of having those two roots is that someone like myself, for example, I can reach into the deep culture of Spain, like Lorca, and not just Lorca, but Lorca's great influence, which were the gypsies, and beyond that, the Arab influence of Spain. So I can draw from all of that world on one side, and yet I can draw from all the other rich world of my indigenous side the poetry of Nezahualcóyotl, for example, the Popol Vuh, all the great Latin American writers. And then, being a Chicano in the United States, I can also tap into all the great literature, poetry written in English. Yes? So I can go from T.S. Eliot to Nezahualcóyotl to Lorca.
What a great number of resources you have. Although there still is that duality, isn't there? Indigenous people, conquistadores, I mean, that sense, of course, it's been brought together through the centuries, but still the division exists.
Well, one of the great concepts of Mesoamerica was the duality, the dual concept of the universe, right? The constant struggle between good and bad, for example, exemplified in the ball game. And although, on the one hand, let's take Mexico as an example, pretends to be very inclusive of its indigenous communities. In fact, we know that it is very oppressive of its indigenous communities. But the same thing applies here in the United States. Yes, we might have the Indian on the buffalo nickel, right? But what have we done to the indigenous communities of the United States? And let me just very gently point out that the genocide of indigenous people on this continent runs about 100 million, a genocide that continues to this day in places like Brazil. Now, let me ask you, where is the monument in the United States of remembrance of that genocide? So you see how, not just in Latin America, but in the United States, we have a schizophrenic approach to our own indigenous society in our own indigenous culture.
Alejandro Murguia with us in studio. And by the way, you can read his Lorca poem on our website. It's in both English and Spanish. It's called Lorca's Dream. And we'll go to more of your calls. Again, you can join us at our toll-free number in the time remaining at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Here's Paula from the Mission District. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Alejandro.
Hi, Paula. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Great to hear you on forum and everything that you're doing. And I was calling regarding The Other Barrio, the film, because you based it, I imagine, on a barrio that is so quickly disappearing. And I'm wondering if you're already thinking of a sequel.
Well, a good question. The Other Barrio, both the story and the film, are from the noir tradition, right? Those things that happen in the darkness. And they happen in the shadows because they are of moral ambiguity. And like so many noir titles, The Other Barrio is the metaphor for death, right? The Big Sleep, The Long Goodbye, Farewell My Lovely, all are metaphors for death, yes? And so in this case, The Other Barrio is both the Mission District, which is disappearing as we make the film, and I'll give you a few examples, and the question of death. So The Other Barrio takes place because it's noir. It's about corruption, deception, lies, murder, sex, you know, the Mission District. But it circulates around specifically arson based on the Gartland apartment arsons of the 1970s. That was the big first gentrified action in the Mission District. And even as we're making the film, right, a huge building burns down at Valencia and DuBois. And you see the backdrop of that building in our movie. And then a big part of the movie takes place at Esta Noche. We film inside Esta Noche. And of course, Esta Noche has recently closed as well. So as we're trying to preserve the Mission District, it is literally disappearing before our eyes.
You say free the mission is the mission.
Free the mission, no evictions. That's our mission.
And also, Cuba comes into your work. There's a really powerful portrait of a Cuban prostitute, but there's also being stopped by a kind of brute of a police officer for a parking ticket. And you feel maybe you're going to be sent to Cuba, but Guantanamo.
Yes, unfortunately, right? And it's something else that sort of bothers me, right? You know, I'm a Latin American, yo soy Chicano, but obviously I'm Latin American. So whatever happens in Latin America impacts me. And I think one of the saddest chapters in the history of the 21st century is that concentration camp in full view of the whole world, in which torture is on the menu every single day. And yet, our government has the audacity and hypocrisy to accuse Cuba of human rights abuses. You know, when President Obama was running for office and he talked about human rights abuses in Cuba, I thought he was referring to Guantanamo.
But you know, you read, and this is admittedly more from the right, you read that those in Guantanamo have recreation, they have good food, they have better conditions than, say, many of the prisoners who are incarcerated in the United States in some pretty terrible festering prisons here, and at least that are not in Cuba.
Well, I would challenge that perception. If you have been held 12 years in a prison without any charges or a chance to defend yourself against charges, and then when you try to protest that inhuman incarceration by using the only weapon you have, which is a hunger strike, we actually bring doctors from our country to go over there and force feed them, which is, to me, another form of torture, yes? Instead of giving that inmate who is protesting on a hunger strike the right to a trial or some sort of judicial process, instead we force feed them.
So what was your reaction to the five Guantanamo prisoners being released in exchange for an army sergeant who had been held 5 years captive by the Taliban and who, by all accounts, may have even been a deserter?
You know, I'm going to kind of point out that all these issues, whether it's prisoners of war, whether it's the incredibly poor treatment of veterans, which is to me very disturbing as well. All of these issues were brought up way before George Bush and Condoleezza Rice invaded Iraq. In fact, there were 50,000 people marching here trying to stop that Iraq war, and people like Dianne Feinstein blew us off, said, yeah, I know better. But she's the one who later goes on and admits that she didn't know better. Right, that she too fell for that incredible magic realism lie that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But nobody believed that, nobody in their right mind. And everybody tried to tell the United States, don't go into Afghanistan. The Soviets told the United States, don't go into Afghanistan. There's nothing to do there but die. And so the blame for all of this, torture, whatever you want, has to go directly to the top, to those people like Condoleezza Rice and George Bush that cooked up this illegal war.
Yeah, I'm struck by what you described when you use magical realism there, which is, you know, associated for the most part with a kind of enchanting Latino writing to a great degree, or Salman Rushdie's writing.
Well, think about it. Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, when everyone knew that, first of all, there were no weapons and there were no delivery systems unless Saddam Hussein was going to deliver them via UPS or perhaps a magic carpet.
Here's Robert, who writes, Oscar Acosta's autobiography is one of my favorite volumes. I have to treat it tenderly to prevent the spine from coming apart.
Absolutely. The autobiography of a brown buffalo is a totally groundbreaking work, especially amongst Latino writing and literature, because there isn't anything like it previous to it, as great as other novels might be, like Bless Me Ultima. And there's nothing quite like the revolt of the cockroach people. And let me just point out that Oscar lived in San Francisco, studied law, got a law degree, and actually went to San Francisco State to study creative writing, but dropped out because he just couldn't fit in.
When you mentioning Bless Me Ultima, that did get a great deal of showcasing. It's taught, you know, throughout the United States, in fact, in many universities. It's become part of that canon of writing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And recently there was a film based on it, yes. But for the most part, Oscar gets cut out of the picture, although in A Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, the Samoan attorney is Oscar. And Samoan was part of his many, many personas that he assumed. But whenever you talk about Fear and Loathing, it's as if Hunter Thompson wrote it and created it all by himself. But he didn't. It was Oscar who taught him how to write like that and how to put himself in the story as a journalist.
And here's another caller joining us. John, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I want to mention a poet that inspired me greatly, and I'm fortunate to call him my friend at this point, Luis Rodriguez. Do you guys know Luis?
Oh, yes.
Yes, indeed.
Very much so. And I'm glad you brought up Luis Rodriguez, because here's something I was very bitterly, but not perhaps unexpectedly, disappointed about. In this whole debate in the newspapers and the media leading up to the election that we had yesterday, it was always phrased as if it was a run between the Democrats and the Republicans. But here we had a chance to vote not just for a poet, which Luis Rodriguez is, and a great writer, by the way, and a great human being, but to vote for an alternative for a Green Party candidate. And let me just point out that even Karl Rove says 35% of the electorate is registered now as independent. Same thing amongst Latino voters. 35% are independent, yes? And so why couldn't the media have given Luis a little bit more space and more publicity, right, so that his profile would have been a little bit higher instead of focusing on these, and I hate to use and offend clowns, but these clowns like Donnelly and stuff where all the emphasis of the media was. And so I was disappointed about that.
Let me read just before we say goodbye to you, Alejandro, a couple of emails as we wrap up here. Geraldine writes, thanks for your constant inspiration, amazing, articulate, intelligent, political, and supremely interesting guest. So it's, I guess, to me. All right. I love listening to your guest read his poems aloud. I'm a photographer with a show, Visual Poetry, inspired by your guest poet Jane Hirschfield from on-air interview a couple years ago, where I've paired photographs with poems and inspired them. The opening reception, I heard viewers reading these poems aloud while looking at the photos. And finally, Patty says, thanks for celebrating poetry. And Alejandro, your dreams have come true. She's got a radio show invitation for you.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.